Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. The former CEO of Pepsi, Academy Award nominees, NFL finalists and players, and a whole host of other careers. My goal is to give those on active duty and those transitioned just tools that they can use in their civilian career. My guest today for episode number 104 is Scott Washburn.
I think the biggest thing is finding something that you're passionate about and really going all in on that. You know, there's no lack of different ways to become an astronaut. If you look at the resumes of people that were just selected, you have Navy SEALs, pilots, you have MIT professors, you have engineers at SpaceX, you have people who specialize in marine biology, doctors, you know, so there's no lack of options on how to get there. I think the biggest thing is finding what you're really passionate about and just going all in on that.
Well, I think you're going to really enjoy this interview with Dr. Scott Washburn. First of all, he has an incredible story he starts the interview with about rescuing a dog unexpectedly at 14,000 feet on Mount Bierstadt, and how months later he was on the Ellen DeGeneres show sharing this story. I think what's most impressive about this interview is Scott has wanted to be an astronaut since a very young age. And he, pursued his PhD. He has done so much in the space industry, and he actually made it to be one of the 50 finalists for the astronaut selection program this year. To put this in perspective, 18,000 people applied, and to make it in the top 50, that is 0.3% or 0.27% of the people that actually made it to that point. And so if you're interested in anything related to the space fields, if you're interested about the PhD process or higher education, it's worth listening to for that. But if you're not, I think it's great to listen to this as well, because it's just a great role model and example of someone who set a huge goal, literally going into outer space. I mean, can you think of anything more intimidating of a goal? And he made it so far on that. And he also is great about talking about what it was like to not make it to that final 12 out of the 15. And so I think it's just a great interview for learning to push yourself, learning to really go to your personal limit and do your best, and how it made him a better person in the process. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes, you'll find descriptions of everything we discuss, as well as timestamps in case you want to hop around. Also, you'll find a special offer for audible.com, which is offering Beyond the Uniform listeners a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is sign up via the beyondtheuniform.io website, and you will get a free audiobook, no strings attached, and Beyond the Uniform gets a couple dollars to help with the production costs. One book that Scott recommended is Chris Hatfield's An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It talks about Chris's journey to becoming an astronaut, as well as little snippets of wisdom that apply to just everyone's life here on Earth. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with fellow submariner Scott Washburn. Well, joining me today in Littleton, Colorado, is Scott Washburn. Scott, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Honored to be here.
For listeners, I wanted to give a quick background on Scott. So Dr. Scott Washburn is a radiation effects engineering manager at Seeker Engineering. He started out at the University of Colorado Boulder, after which he served in the Navy as a submarine officer for 5 years. When he first left the Navy, he worked as a thermal and project engineer at the Space Systems Laurel, or SSL, after which he returned to the University of Colorado Boulder for his master's and then his PhD in aerospace engineering. Since then, he has worked as chief engineer at Garion Space Technologies, as well as research engineer at NASA. Scott was also one of the 50 finalists of the astronaut selection program. So, Scott, usually I start with kind of the story of what you're up to right now, but first I was tipped off that there is a story about you, your wife, Amanda, summiting Mount Bierstadt, a German Shepherd, and the Ellen DeGeneres show. Could you share a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story, and I'll try and give you a somewhat abbreviated version because it's a long story. But so for your listeners who don't know what a 14er is, where this kind of story starts at, a 14er is a mountain that's over 14,000 feet tall, MSL. And it's a big thing in Colorado. People go hike all these 14ers. There's, you know, 50 some in the state. And so this was back in 2012. My wife and I went to hike Mount Bierstadt, which is one of the pretty popular 14ers here in the state. And we were actually going to do two peaks. So there's a peak right next to it called Mount Evans. And so there's a little traverse in between them. And my wife and I were doing the traverse and got a little bit off course. And I was maybe 100 yards ahead of my wife, and she called out to me, "Hey, come back here. I found a dog." And I, you know, I thought I misheard her because I figured there's no way there's a dog up here. So I went running back, and sure enough, my wife had found this this big German Shepherd tucked under the rocks. And I was making all sorts of funny noises, and we weren't really sure what was going on, and, you know, kind of worked our way in there and got close to it, and realized it was really labored breathing. The dog has, her muzzle was basically, she was breathing out of one nostril. Her muzzle was sealed shut because her saliva was so thick, and one of her nostrils was clogged. And so we got her some water and, you know, kind of got her rejuvenated and breathing again, and couldn't figure out for the life of us how she had got there all by herself. People take dogs on 14ers, you know, fairly frequently, but this was not an area where you particularly want to take a dog. So we tried figuring out how to carry her out, and we tried, you know, firemen carrying her and throwing over our shoulders and then taking turns and each grabbing an end, and ultimately had to give up. The terrain was really gnarly. It's these big, unstable boulders that you're kind of hopping between, and we decided if we were going to try and pull her out by ourselves, we were probably going to really injure ourselves. So we, you know, we took a few bearings so we could locate her later, and then we, you know, ran down the mountain as fast as we could and found a park ranger who informed us that they wouldn't be able to help. The only way they'd be able to help is by sending someone up to shoot the dog. And we told them, no, don't go shoot that dog. We'll figure something out. We drove back to Denver. My wife is calling every rescue group we can think of, and we just couldn't get any help to help us go get this dog. We got back into town. We weren't sure what to do. And there's a website called 14ers.com where people post trip reports or information about different trails, so you can kind of see how the terrain is and weather and stuff like that. And they have little, you know, chat boards on there. So we got on there and we posted about this dog and said, "Hey, you know, if you happen to be up there, please, you know, here's where this dog is roughly. Please bring her food and water, and we're going to try and put together a rescue group." So we got this huge outpouring of responses. We were planning on going up the next day. Unfortunately, the group kind of fell through. So 2 days later, we were able to get a group of eight other guys up there, and we met at the trailhead early in the morning. And unfortunately, since, you know, we weren't able to get enough people together the day before, I was a little nervous we were going to be hiking in to unfortunately find a dead dog. But we got up there, and lucky enough, we found this dog, and she was still alive. So we got her food and water, and we actually loaded her in this huge backpack and took turns hiking her out, you know, with one guy with the backpack and then two spotters to help navigate through these rocks until we got to, you know, better terrain. And we were able to, you know, zip her down into the city, and we had found a veterinarian who had contacted us on 14ers.com and offered his assistance. He said, you know, if you find her and she's alive, bring her straight here and I'll take care of her. So we did that. And turned out she was in pretty good shape, all things considered. She had her pads completely torn off and, you know, a little dehydrated, but other than that, in pretty good shape. And, you know, we kind of figured that was the end of the story. It was a nice, you know, nice little thing to have done. It somehow reached its way to the local news. And so there was a little local news story that night on, you know, one of the local TV stations. And from that point, it just kind of exploded, which we really didn't anticipate. And part of the reason it exploded is the owner of the dog saw that news story and then contacted us on 14ers.com and said, "Hey, thanks for saving my dog. I'd really like to have her back." And, you know, the initial response was, or thought was, "God, no." But we asked him, "Okay, you know, what, tell us why you want this dog back and, or why, you know, what happened and why you deserve the dog back." And he basically had told us, you know, he was up there with a kid hiking, and that a thunderstorm had rolled in and the dog had torn up her paws and wouldn't walk anymore. So he made the decision to leave the dog and save himself. And, you know, we told him, "Yeah, that, you know, I understand all of that. You abandoned the dog to save yourself. Like, I get that decision. People die on 14ers all the time because they got struck by lightning. But, you know, you never even tried to get the dog back. You never posted signs or went through any type of effort to get the dog back. You know, my wife and I found this dog, and not even knowing about her or knowing her at all, we made all this effort to go rescue her. So, you know, I'm sorry, but we're keeping the dog." And of course, that's when things really blew up. It kind of got all over the place on social media, and we got contacted by a bunch of different news organizations, and we went on Good Morning America, and then we were eventually contacted by Ellen DeGeneres' people on the Ellen DeGeneres Show, and they invited us to come on. And yeah, that was just such like a really cool experience. We got to go and meet her and be on the show, and yeah, that was, she's just a really an incredible person and a huge dog lover. So it was just a really neat experience.
That's incredible. I just love the, I love that resilience of just going through all of that to save a dog. I'm a huge dog lover. We've got a 5-year-old rescue dog, Hemingway, and I can't imagine having him stranded up there. And so I love that you guys took that extra initiative to just see him home safely. And one of the guys that helped you rescue him ended up adopting him. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He actually runs a German Shepherd rescue here in Colorado, and so he loves German Shepherds. He jumped right on the chance to go help one, and yeah, it was a great fit. He had two at home, and yeah, it worked out great.
Man. Well, switching gears more to the main subject, if you were chatting with someone who was on active duty, how would you explain what you do for a living right now?
Yeah, so... The short version is that the team I participate in, we test and analyze how electronics work in the space radiation environment. And what a lot of people may not be very familiar with is there's actually a huge radiation environment in space, and it's a little bit different than, you know, what you're familiar with here on Earth. You know, it's different than getting x-rays at the doctors, or what you even might find at a nuclear power plant. So the space environment is just constantly being barraged by radiation, and this particular type of radiation, actually atomic nuclei, that are zipping all around the galaxy at incredible speeds. And they're so energetic, they'll penetrate a spacecraft and zip right through a piece of electronics or even a human, and they can cause a huge amount of damage. So what my group does is we go out and test different electronic components and see how they react in that environment. And then we analyze the designs that we build here at my company, which is different types of space electronics and computing systems, and see, you know, how these things will perform in the radiation environment. So kind of a long-winded answer. But,
no, this but is great. I should disclose, I am a huge sci-fi nut, and I love reading science fiction, and loved, in the fiction world, love Mary Roach's book, what was it? It's Packing for Mars. I just love all this stuff space-related, so I'm just... grinning ear to ear as you're describing all this. I think it'd be such an incredible thing to do.
Yeah, well, I am a space nerd, to be sure.
So. Well, I always like to kind of back up to give listeners a sense of how you got here. And so when you were on active duty, how did you first decide that you were going to transition out of the Navy?
Well, you know, it was a really tough decision for me. I initially signed up for the Navy really only intending to do my 5-year commitment and get out, which obviously is what I did end up doing. But I loved the Navy. I just loved the Navy and the submarine force in particular. I loved the job. I loved the mission. I loved the people. And so when I kind of was nearing the end of my term, I really struggled with, is it the right decision to get in or to stay in or get out? And the reason I really wanted to get out was because I've always wanted to be an astronaut. That's kind of been the driving theme in my life. And I knew that there was a chance I could get there as a submarine officer. There has been one selected previously back in 2000. It's Commander Stephen Bowen. I think he's a captain now, actually. And they actually recently selected an active duty submariner in this most recent selection cycle. But I wasn't sure how to set myself apart from the crowd as just a generic submarine officer. So I thought that, in order to improve my odds, that I would get out and start working in aerospace. And I've been passionate about the space industry and space exploration my entire life. So that was an industry that I really wanted to be a part of and really wanted to work in. That was kind of the driving thing behind that decision to get out.
And so, when you made that decision to leave the Navy, how did you know what you wanted to do first? I think it's always helpful for listeners, especially those on active duty, to get a sense of like how you approached that first job search and what ended up leading you initially to the SSL.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a fortuitous opportunity that came up that led me to SSL. There was another active duty, well, another former submariner, who worked there, was familiar with, what veterans and submariners are capable of. And so I ended up working with a recruiting agency who had placed him there previously, and they called him up and told him, hey, I've got another submarine veteran. Do you have a place for him? And so that's kind of how I found my home at SSL. I didn't have a real clear picture when I left about how I was going to go about doing that. And so I actually spent quite a bit of time unemployed after leaving the service, just because I hadn't planned very well. I knew I wanted to work in the space industry, and I wasn't aware of how stiff the competition was working in aerospace engineering and what types of different opportunities were out there. So, I kind of didn't really hit the ground and start moving on that until I was actually fully separated from the service.
I don't think you're alone on that at all. I think it's, one of the motivations from this show is just to give people a sense of even what's out there. And I know I had no idea when I left, other than just knowing it was something in business and that led me to business school. But I imagine, especially at the time that you got out, there's not a lot of role models you can reach out to see like, hey, if my intention is to become an astronaut, how do I get from here to there? Because it seems like this insurmountable obstacle of how to even start that journey.
Yeah, there really isn't a lot of, there's not a clear-cut path. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and regardless of how you choose to tackle the problem, it's nothing's guaranteed, right? You can have the best resume. That certainly doesn't mean you're going to be an astronaut or even get an interview to be one. So, again, there's not a lot of people who make, in particular, the submarine to aerospace transition either, so... That was particularly challenging. And I think now there seems to be a lot more resources, or perhaps when I got out there were all the same resources, I just wasn't aware of them. But I think there's a lot of good resources and awareness of those resources now, at least I hope, to veterans getting out.
And what was your role like there as this thermal and project engineer, and what ultimately motivated you to go back to school?
So my role was pretty different than my day-to-day in the submarine force. In the submarine force, my extent of engineering was more operationally focused, and that was my day. As an engineer at Space Systems Loral, it was very, kind of nuts and bolts, doing the math and building models type of engineering. So I spent, you know, majority of my day in front of a computer, building models of satellites and thermal systems and how all these things work together and what temperatures they would reach during the orbit and interacting with all sorts of different engineering teams. So it was a pretty big transition. I think one of the things that really motivated me to go back to grad school was I found myself in a really, kind of hard engineering environment. And most of my engineering skills that I had learned, in undergrad had gotten pretty soft. So, after spending about 2 years, a year at Loral, that's when I decided to go back to grad school and ended up going to grad school after I'd been there for 2 years, just because, I felt like in order to get up to speed with the rest of my coworkers, I was trying to take classes on, nights and weekends and stuff, and I just wasn't getting to where I needed to be fast enough. So I decided to, kind of put myself in grad school full time as a way to ramp back up.
I'm just curious, do you have any thoughts if someone's considering going to school directly after active duty versus, you had a couple years experience, which I was the opposite. I went straight to business school, and I there's some things I regret about that, of just not having a lot of context for appreciating the education I was receiving. And so I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that straight to education path versus getting a little bit of experience in industry first.
I'm kind of 50-50 on that issue. For me, not having a real good feel for the industry itself, I think it was beneficial for me to go work in the industry for a little bit before I went back to grad school. I certainly see the case where if you have a really good idea of what you want to do or, a general field that you want to work in, going back to graduate school right out of the gate is a great way to go. And I think there's a lot of advantages to that too, in terms of just the transition to civilian life. It's certainly not an easy transition. It's one that I really struggled with. And going back to grad school, I think, is a good kind of intermediary into that new life.
And did you know when you went back, was the ultimate goal a PhD, or at what point did that emerge as the strategy?
It was kind of an idea, but I hadn't really gone back to grad school with the idea of getting a PhD. My initial plan was, okay, I'll just do the master's and then go back and work in industry or, at NASA, something along those lines. And so it was after my first year, I was awarded, it's called an NDSEG fellowship, a National Defense Science and Engineering Graduate Fellowship. So quite a mouthful. The really nice thing about that fellowship was it gave me the opportunity to study any particular topic that I want or that I wanted. I had really gone back to grad school with the idea that I wanted to sort of merge my naval nuclear background with aerospace, looking at things like space nuclear reactors or space radiation. And there wasn't really a graduate program for that. And this fellowship sort of gave me the opportunity to forge my own path and really focus in on what became the space radiation aspect of it. So because I enjoyed that topic so much, I decided, okay, I'll just take an extra 2 years on top of my master's and focus on this singular topic and do a PhD in it.
I always admire PhD students. It seems like the mental Olympics where you just dedicate yourself to one thing, which is the furthest extreme I can think of to an MBA where you're just a generalist on everything. And just out of curiosity, what was your dissertation?
I'm trying to remember the exact title of it. It's long and really obscure. Magnetic Shielding. I can't remember the title, which is kind of sad, but basically the idea was using magnetic fields to shield humans from the space radiation environment.
That's awesome. And for those listening who might be interested in pursuing a PhD, how would you describe that experience and any advice that you have to them about pursuing a PhD?
I think one nice thing about being a veteran and pursuing programs like that is you're a little bit more, you know, brass tacks, let's get down to business and knock it out. You know, I knocked mine out in 2 years, which was a pretty short time frame, and a lot of the other, you know, ex-service members that I met there were kind of the same mentality. So it's a little bit different. You're more focused and ready to just, you know, crank through that type of stuff and get the job done. I guess my piece of advice to give is don't get it just to get it. Make sure it's a topic that you're really interested in, because as soon as you walk out the door with that piece of paper that says you're an expert in, you know, X, that's what you are. So if you're looking to maybe branch out to other fields or something like that, that becomes very difficult. You become very entrenched in that field. So, you know, really make sure that that's what you want to do and where you want to be going with your career.
And, you know, it sounds like this was an early ambition of yours to be an astronaut eventually. How did you make distance down track towards that goal? Like, how did the even entering into that program start?
So I wasn't, it's not really a training program or anything. Submitted my application back in, I guess it was early last year, is when they started up the application process for the group that was selected this year. It was 18,000 plus people who put in for the initial application, and then they gradually whittle it down to 120 semifinalists who come in for a 3-day interview, and then 50 finalists who come in for a full week-long interview. And from that 50, this year they selected 12 to be a part of that, or to be a part of the astronaut corps and start actually training to be an astronaut. And so those guys are going to go on a 2-year training cycle, covering everything under the sun, from, you know, wilderness survival to underwater egress from a vehicle to Russian language and International Space Station systems. But the first starting point is just applying for the program. And for me, you know, it's been a lifelong dream. So I've kind of plotted along the way of, you know, what are my interests, and what things can I add on that might help me get there? And so working in the space industry is one, you know, being a submarine officer in the Navy was another thing that helped to get me there. And that was, you know, part of my initial considerations on getting into the submarine service. I wanted to serve my country in general, but I looked around for, okay, you know, what might be a good similarity to being in space? And so I decided to join the submarine service, actually, and I signed up in 1999. And in 2000, NASA selected its first submarine officer. So that ended up playing out pretty well. You know, and I just tried to find little things along the way that I thought, you know, would help get me there. I got my private pilot's license, got my scuba diving certification, little things like that. I mean, there were things that I wanted to do anyway that I found really interesting and exciting, but there were also things that, you know, worked into what they're looking for astronauts.
What was, I mean, I think it's just incredible to think of even 18,000 down to the 120 and then down to the 50. So it's like a 0.3% of people who applied made it to the point that you did. What was the application process like? Is this like a written, just kind of like a typical written application as the starting point?
Yeah. It's just a standard online application through the USA Jobs website. So you just put in your resume like you normally would. And there's a few follow-up questions about, you know, vision and some of the basic medical requirements, if you are a pilot or not. But yeah, it's pretty simple. You know, once that's in the door, then NASA starts chomping away at it. I heard that they had over 50 different HR specialists that they pulled in from all the different centers to help churn through all those resumes and start to narrow them down.
And I'm not sure if you're allowed to talk about it, but I'm curious, once you made it to that group of 120, you talked about this 3-day interview, which to me sounds so awful to think of being on under observation for 3 days. But what was that process like?
It was awesome. I mean, that was one of the coolest experiences of my life. It's covered under a ton of NDAs, so I can't talk a lot about the details of it. But it was just an incredible experience. They're kind of evaluating you as a person. They're also doing a little bit of medical screening at that point to make sure, okay, this person can be a viable astronaut candidate. The medical requirements are very strict. There's lots of different things that can disqualify you from space flight. One major example they always give is kidney stones. If you've ever had kidney stones, that's a disqualification just because your body relies on gravity to pass kidney stones. Well, if you're up in space, you can't pass a kidney stone, and that could become a really big problem. So there's a fair amount of medical screening that comes along with it. But yeah, the whole process was just, I kept calling it adult space camp. So it was really cool.
That's awesome. If someone listening is interested in going this route, and I'm sure there are people who aspire to that as well, any advice in particular about how to make it as far as you did, to make it to that 0.3%, to that final round of review?
I think the biggest thing is finding something that you're passionate about and really, really going all in on that. There's no lack of different ways to get or to become an astronaut. If you look at the resumes of, even the people that were just elected, you have Navy SEALs. Excuse me, you have Navy SEALs, you have pilots, you have MIT professors, you have engineers at SpaceX. You have people who specialize in marine biology, doctors, so there's no lack of options on how to get there. I think the biggest thing is finding what you're really passionate about and just going all in on that. That's really important for them, is just finding people who excel in their fields and push themselves constantly. And I think that that's another big recommendation or piece of advice, is just constantly work to improve yourself and make yourself better. Find things that challenge you and really push your skills, push your boundaries, and get right on the edge of your comfort zone and push you beyond that. And that's another big thing that they really look for.
I think that's great advice for anyone. I feel energized and motivated just hearing about that, of just wanting to just push yourself. And it seems like, even from the little snippets of your story I've heard, from just 14ers and pilot's license and scuba diving, like, you've definitely really gone, had the ambition of getting the most out of each year of life, and I really admire that.
Yeah, well, thanks.
One
Yeah,
thing.
it's been a fun adventure, like pursuing all those different things, whether you make it as an astronaut or not, it definitely can look back and say you've done some really cool things and you've enjoyed it along the way.
One thing I wanted to ask about is just, what that was, and the degree to which you're comfortable talking about it, what that was like making it that far, having this lifelong ambition, and then not making that minuscule percentage of people who actually get to the 12 finalists. And I, for perspective, I run a startup. It's been a great experience. When I started it 8 years ago, I thought it would be we would IPO and we would be the next Facebook, and it hasn't turned out like that exactly yet. And so, I've had my own struggle of just kind of reconciling what the original dream is and then where that goes. And I'm just curious what that was like, and any advice you have for people who may set their goals astronomically high and really, swing for the fences, and it doesn't work out exactly as they'd expected.
Boy, I guess I'll talk first about kind of how that felt. Because it was, honestly, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. I feel like when I got the news, it was kind of in one way, a crushing blow because, yeah, I spent so many years in pursuit of this goal. But at the same time, it was kind of, it was kind of like, well, okay, you know. And I think part of the reason for that is when you make it to the final 50, every single person there is just, they're some of the most incredible people you will ever meet in your entire life. I mean, and it's something that they've been pursuing their entire lives too. I mean, whatever they do, whether they're a doctor or a pilot or, a marine biologist, they are the best in their field, and it's something that they've been pursuing their whole life. And then they're just really incredible people to, you know, aside from all that. So, you know, when I wasn't selected, it was kind of like, well, okay, you didn't take me, but, you know, it's hard to get too upset when I know the other people who did get selected because they're pretty incredible people. So it was, almost bittersweet in that aspect. You know, it's hard to get too upset about it. And, you know, like I've got a few friends who are astronauts now, so that's not too shabby. let's see. I don't know. I guess, looking back along the journey, you kind of have at some point have to realize, especially when you're swinging for the fences and going for something that's so, it's almost audacious, right? The odds of getting selected are so low. You have to really temper your expectations and make sure that, hey, if this doesn't work out, are you still okay with where you end up? And I think that, you know, reevaluating where I am in my life, having not made it, to my end goal, but having come really close, I'm okay with where I ended up at. You know, I've got a great family, great friends, a great job. I've had all these incredible experiences. It's a hard thing to, it's hard to regret any of it.
Mm. I just love this image of looking around this room of 49 other people and just being in awe and just the gratitude to be in that company. And I'm imagining the realization that these other people are looking at you in the same light of like, man, this guy was a submarine officer, he's a pilot, he's done all this stuff. And so just to even have that as your peer set is really incredible. My hat's off to you on all of that.
Yeah, well, thanks.
I'm curious, I always like to ask people about resources, books, websites, programs, conferences, just anything that you've done along the way that's helped you in your civilian career that might help someone listening as well.
I didn't have a ton of resources that I relied on. I think one of the things I found recently that I've kind of gone back to quite a bit is actually, it's of course space related, go figure. it's Chris Hadfield's book. It's called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. And it's just this really incredible book. It talks about his path to becoming an astronaut. But there's so many little snippets of wisdom in there that I think apply to everyday life, just about how to go after things in a way that doesn't matter if you're, you know, trying to be an astronaut or any other pursuit, just some really good life lessons and valuable things to try and integrate into your own life.
That's awesome. And I probably mispronounced that. Is it Geron Space Technologies?
Garion.
And you're also have done work as a research engineer at NASA. What was that time like at NASA? And any advice to those listening, aspiring to work there one day?
Yeah, so actually, I participated as a co-investigator on a NASA study, so I didn't actually go to a NASA research center. I did all my research from the University of Colorado, so pretty cool experience, getting to work with those guys and both a couple of the different NASA research centers and civil servants. I think if you are really interested in pursuing that path, there's lots of great opportunities to get involved. There's if you're, undergrad or in graduate school, there's lots of internships and co-ops that are a great way to get your foot in the door. Just reaching out and kind of tapping into that network. I think One of the really cool things about NASA is everyone there is just so excited about what they do, and they're so passionate about it. They're more than willing to share those experiences with people and get involved. So, you know, if you find something that you're interested in, find the person at NASA who's looking into it and reach out to them. I think you'd be really surprised at how willing they are to respond back to you and engage with you.
That's great. Well, I always like to end with a more open-ended question, and that's just knowing that you've got an audience of active duty and recently and anciently transitioned veterans listening to the show. Any other final words of wisdom that you'd want them to know? It could be about work, about life, or just anything that is top of mind for you right now.
Yeah. Boy, I think the biggest thing would be just, you know, find your passion. You know, I think it's worthwhile, you know, especially during times of big transition, if you're an active duty service member and you're looking to get out, or, you know, just at different points in your life, just take stock of your world and what you like and what you don't like, and make sure that you're striving for those things. It's something I wish I had spent a little bit more time doing when I transitioned out. I was taking a look at all of the different things that I liked about military service and looking at how I could fit those into my day-to-day life once I got out. I think for me, that was personally one of the big struggles, is many of the things I loved in the service were absent in the civilian world. So I spent a lot of time trying to find that in my job and realized, you know, it was something I was going to have to find in outside activities. You know, that sense of service for me was a really big one that I had trouble finding in the civilian world. So, you know, I guess that's my biggest piece of advice. Spend some time taking stock of the things you like in this world and figuring out how to get more of those, or if they're absent, figuring out how to get them as part of your world.
This is great. Well, Scott, I appreciate your advice. I appreciate your role model for the veteran community. I love that. Just that image of constantly pushing yourself and finding ways to fill in those things that you valued in one's service. I know that's a theme that's come up before, is just there are so many needs met by military service, and it's hard to replicate that on the outside. So I love that thought of just continuously looking for ways to find that either in work or outside of work. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
Service.
All right, listeners, welcome back to Planet Earth after our otherworldly interview with Scott. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you do like it, make sure you sign up for our newsletter at beyondtheuniform.io. If you got a couple minutes standing in line at Starbucks, if you go to the iTunes store and give us a great rating on the podcast platform there, that will help. As well as if you didn't already sign up for an Audible free trial at beyondtheuniform.io/books, you'll get a free audiobook. It's a great way to use net time or no extra time to fly through different books that you might not get to in reading. So with that, I leave you for the week. Looking forward to more interviews from veterans in their civilian career next week. Thanks.